Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's November 7th, 2021, and welcome to episode 245 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, reflecting on collecting, figuring out what to do with all that stuff after you're not there to take care of it, and that sort of thing. I'm Paul Hextrom in Boston. I am joined today by many retro computing enthusiasts this time. Making a triumphant return is Michael Mulhern in Sydney. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much. The seasons have aligned, and hopefully I can say I'm back.
Hooray. Well, welcome back. Also joining us from Los Angeles is Quinn Dunkey. How are you?
I'm very good.
Excellent. Thumbs up. A silent thumbs up.
I have nothing to add to that, really.
And that's how you keep a show to an hour, folks. That's right.
Exactly. Well, now we've talked about how short my reply was for another 5 minutes, so there it goes.
Perfect.
And that, folks, is how we go to 3 hours.
That's probably the shortest reply that I've heard on this show.
Yeah. Also joining us from Northern Virginia is Blake Patterson. How are you?
I do well. No, I'm doing well. I'm beating Quinn at the short intro. Doing well. Weather's getting autumny, and glad to be here. Yeah, that's about it.
And lastly, we have Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you?
Me, good. Weather cold.
Excellent. Yeah, weather is increasingly coldifying here too. But all right. Well, I think that's been an interesting week. So I think what we decided we would talk about this time is estate planning in general. The kinds of things we need to think about with the physical objects or intellectual properties or accounts that we host or archives that we have. Thinking about what sort of plans we ought to make, maybe have made, or know we should make, any sort of ideas we have about how to go about that for either expected or unexpected departures. I think this has been brought up by the rather unexpected passing of Tony Diaz from the Apple II community, and so one of the things that brings up, we all of us on the podcast here knew him relatively well. We had all interacted with him in his sort of capacity as a Kansas Fest organizer and personality. He was a pretty oversized personality in the Apple II world, but also had some, I think, notoriety even outside of that in terms of like the Prince of Persia source code salvage and stuff like that. And the one aspect of this is that he had a lot of sort of rare items. He'd been sort of collecting Apple stuff for a long time. He hosted a lot of sites. He has a lot of archives. And it's not really clear what the future of any of that is at the moment. And
he also hosted the Apple II IRC server, right? Actually, that we use.
Right. And so this was not expected. I don't know. I'm not sure that any of us here, I'm pretty sure that none of us do actually have any actual information about like what the disposition of any of these things are, about the intellectual property or the sites or the logins or archives or any of that. But it does make us think, regardless of what happens to this set of stuff, we should think about the stuff that we have control over. So I know that I have similarly, you know, tons of stuff on my hard drive, you know, all kinds of things that, you know, boxes of stuff that are waiting to be processed. What happens if unexpectedly they are not processed? So anyway, that was just sort of the intro that led us to talk about this topic. Specifically about Tony, maybe I could point people to the Open Apple podcast. There was just a revival of that podcast for this event, for that. There's a show that Em and Ken went back and recorded. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes. You can go to that if you wanted to hear more about Tony specifically. But we can maybe turn mostly our focus to the estate planning. Although, I mean, I'm the only one that's gotten a chance to talk here. So if other people want to say things about Tony too, that's cool. Anyone wanted to jump in?
Well, I just wanted to sort of bring up that people have interesting ways of affecting other people. Now, a friend of mine, Sean, brought up that his WozFest retro get-togethers that he hosts at his place came about purely because Tony had visited an Apple OzFest here in Australia. And he had bought some of those aforementioned interesting Apple pieces that he had. It was sort of like a flying tour. So Sean thought it'd be a good idea that some of us local Greater Sydney area people have a look at these. So we did. And it was, from my perspective, it was a good chance to catch up with Tony again and other people that I knew. Little did we know that became WozFest 1, and we have now just recently had WozFest 22. So that little get-together to have an informed and bewildering gawk at the treats that Tony brought over had a long-lasting impact. So, you know, tangents happen, so sliding doors happen. What would have happened if Tony hadn't brought that stuff with him? Would we have had this great little 3-4 times a year get together? So yeah, it's a sliding doors moment with Tony, and it's basically brought us together. And what started off as an Apple-centric get together, we've had, you know, Hitachi Peaches, various pieces of Japanese computing history, apart from the mainstream stuff. You know, we've had x86 computers from back in the day, and I'm loving it. It's a great retro computing experience, and that's basically, you know, my sliding doors moment with Tony. And as far as a friend goes, I'll miss him.
I'll jump in there. I guess I didn't know Tony super well, but I can. I guess my first memory of him was when he walked through the lobby at Kansas Fest holding the Mark Twain GS, which, as far as I knew, was only rumored to exist, and he was holding it. And I believe it's the only one possibly that does exist. And it was the never completed ROM 4 version of the 2GS that had the internal floppy drive. And so seeing it was just, it was like seeing a unicorn, and that was pretty amazing. And that was just sort of the tip of the iceberg of his collection, which, you know, I think for someone like him, estate planning is a really big deal, because he has legit precious artifacts from, you know, the Apple II era. And someone like me, I'm just a hobbyist. You know, I have a couple of machines in my mom's basement. My approach to estate planning is basically, when I'm dead, I don't really care what happens to that stuff, let's be honest. You know, I don't have anything especially valuable or rare, so if it ends up at Goodwill or in the trash, honestly, it's probably fine. One approach to estate planning is to give the stuff to someone else while you're still alive. That's something that accidentally happened to me. I haven't ever admitted this in public before, but I actually own a Commodore 64. It is, I know. Yes.
You can kick her from the podcast, right, Paul? You
have that. I think I'll look for the button.
Yeah. So yeah, I had a friend
just
who.
I'm just going to reach for the eject lever.
Yeah. I just did an ejection motion for the people listening in the audio-only format. So I was, yeah, he was needing to clean out his mom's basement, and he wasn't interested in this stuff anymore, and I sort of was. So he was a good friend of mine from, you know, back in the day, and he still had his original Commodore in his basement. And I was like, well, I'll take it. And so I had visions of playing with it because I've always been, you know, Commodore curious, as it were. I've always been interested in playing the games that they had and playing with Amigas lately, but I never actually did get around to it, so it's been sitting in a box in my parents' basement ever since. But so, you know, yeah, that's another machine that's just not rare or special, so if it ends up in the trash when I'm gone, that's frankly fine. I guess that's my approach. Yeah.
As far as Tony, I'll jump in. I mentioned when you were talking, Paul, the IRC server. I guess my biggest interaction with him over the years was, on IRC chat for, I guess, probably over two decades. And that server went down here very recently. I went in to try to get news, and you know, it was down. And that sort of tied together. I will say, Quinn, you mentioned the Mark Twain. I met Tony. He came to my house. He was fond of road trips, and I think he was driving from, you know, to Kansas City, and he was in the DC area, and I offered him a large color Next CRT, and he came to pick it up, and he had the Mark Twain GS with him, and so I've got photographs of it laying on in the street in front of my house, and that was the unicorn moment for me. So yeah, those are treasured photos. But but anyway, so yeah, just to add a little note there on Tony. Mm-hmm.
But that's it. That, I think, is, I mean, like, it's a little shocking in a way that, like, the IRC that has been, like, the place that people have gathered or whatever, it was kind of run out of a, you know, machine in the corner of his room, you know? Right? So yeah, it's not there anymore.
I mean, it's interesting, you know, like, what was particularly interesting, I mean, there weren't that many people that were regularly on it. Like, I stayed logged in all the time with a terminal-based, you know, IRC client. I saw, you know, I heard the news, and I went to look at the IRC, and I noticed that, you know, it indicated some days had passed, so I wasn't connected anymore. And I looked, and the client had been trying to reconnect every 2 minutes for a couple of days. And I could look back at the scroll and see when the server went offline. And I could also see, the last, hey, you know, see you later, from Tony, his conversation. It's just weird to have the scroll back there, but the server's not there anymore, and I don't know that it'll ever come back. But that was where the, like, a clutch of Apple II people really, for decades, for my part, went, chatted, you know, hey, look what I'm working on. And that was a nice thing. I hope, you know, one day that gets picked back up again. But, you know, yeah, you're right. That's a corner of the community that was a big corner for me, even if it, you know, maybe wasn't for most. But yeah, mm-hmm. That's gone now.
You touched on something important there, which is that, you know, as a community, we have very small points of failure. You know, as we say in software engineering, certain people's bus factors are very high. And, you know, as a civilization, the way we solve this problem is by distributing these important things so that it's not dependent on any one person. So a collection as valuable as Tony's, you know, should really be with an institution of some sort that will outlive any individual, so that we don't have these small points of failure like this. Because now, you know, we have this basement full of priceless artifacts that his family may not know what to do with, or have any idea, you know, what's valuable, what's not, what the history is of some of this stuff. I'm guessing a lot of it, as far as the history, also was in Tony's head. I don't know how much of it was written down.
Sure.
You know, so these are, you know, record keeping and distribution of responsibility definitely helps prevent this sort of situation.
Yeah, that's one of the things that is really sad about this, is that, you know, even given that the objects might be handled properly, the story about how he came to have them, what, you know, what led them to be like they were, you know, those are likely gone, except in, you know, some captured IRC chat logs or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I know, you know, as I indicated, there's a couple of stories Tony shared with me that I intend down the road to share online. more publicly. But, you know, in those stories, I'm aware of the fact that, you know, there are certain like key items that are, you know, in his collection, but there are separate, physically separate items that are part of that story that no one would possibly link them, you know, together. And that's, I'm sure, a physically distant place in his very large, you know, storage space. And so, yeah, it's without him to, you know, to have to kind of talk about, oh, this actually belongs with this because of this thing. You know, there's no, that's lost. And so aside from where he's, you know, shared that with other people. So, and I'm sure he's done that to an extent, but not every story, obviously.
Yeah. On the topic of, like, how do we deal with estate planning? How do you deal with when you have a collection? Obviously, I know a lot about that. Look around me. But,
who's going to get your couch, Carrington, now that you have one?
Anybody can have it. It's the worst couch ever in the history of couches. It's a temporary couch while I'm waiting for my real one. It's awful. Don't remind me. Take my couch, please. I'll be here all week. It's too bad Jack's not here because they've got this thing in Sweden that I've been meaning to ask Jack if it's something people outside of Sweden think that happens in Sweden, or if it's actually something that happens in Sweden, which is called Swedish death cleaning. I don't know if you guys are aware of the term Swedish death cleaning. They probably just call it death cleaning, being in Sweden.
Yes. Well, in Sweden, it's like the food.
It's this idea that as you get older, there comes a point where you should embrace the fact that you are mortal, and you have an obligation not to leave a burden of your stuff on the people that stick around after you. Because other than maybe Paul, almost all of us are not Tony Diaz, and we have collections that are, in the grand scheme of things, essentially worthless. They're worth things to us, but the funds maybe that could be generated from them in an estate sale put upon that you impose on your kids, who are also dealing with the fact that they found you dead, is maybe not worth it. Like, and so separating the rare few things you have of value, and maybe letting your family know that the rest of this should go in a truck to Kansas City or whatever, and don't worry about it. That yes, it could generate $500, $1,000, $8, whatever, plus shipping, plus a handler, plus none of that's worth it. These two items, mom and dad, this is what you should take to a collector, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Not because you're trying to maximize value for them, but because you're trying to minimize impact on the people after you who shouldn't have to deal with your stuff. You loved your stuff. But they don't have to. My girlfriend, check your bingo boxes, lives in Canada. You wouldn't know her. Canada's real. Don't listen to Quinn. She was willed a stamp book by an uncle. And we were talking about it weirdly. Like, it's weird. Weirdly, this timing is interesting for me because a couple weeks ago, I picked auction items for this show, not from eBay, specifically because I was going to mention, hey, here's a place where people will handle estates and stuff. So I'm like, that's weird timing. But also, like a week ago, I was talking to my girlfriend about how she has a book of stamps that she got from her uncle, who was a massive stamp collector and left three giant books of stamps to three different nieces. And she's one of them. And she has taken that book of stamps from house to house to house to house because she feels too guilty to go and get it appraised to sell. But she's also not a stamp collector. So she just, and I said, well, what are you eventually going to do with these stamps? Like, she goes, ideally, I leave them to someone else when I die. And these stamps will simply pass down until you get so far from the originator that they feel no compulsion about getting it sold. So maybe you got to put yourself in the mindset of the people after you and think, what does a non-Apple II, non-Commodore, non-IBM, non-vintage computer lover, what do they want from this? And what they want is an association with you. What they want is to maybe a reminder of what you love. But is your collection a Tony Diaz collection, a museum collection, or is it the 17th Commodore 64 that honestly just give it to it, find a good home for that puppy and take burdens away from you? So I think estate planning should be mostly about minimizing difficulty and harm for your people who come after you.
Yeah. Well, you said an important word there, which is will. You know, there are people, I mean, estate planning is a thing that people do. Professionals would say that the way you specify what's important and what is garbage is by what's in your will and what's not. And so the stamp books have value, whether, you know, emotional or otherwise. And so they were in the will, and everything else is just, can be assumed to be garbage. So I think that's a perfectly reasonable approach, is I think any estate planning lawyer would say, yeah, like when you hit 40 or so, you should have a will, and you know, you should list everything that's important, and you should update it periodically. I know none of us do that, but.
So how do you do that? How do you list the Commodore 64 value? Like, Paul, how would you do that? You've got tons of things. How do you tell somebody who doesn't know what you know how to find that one? Like, when you name it, they'll look around and go like, well, which one is this?
Yeah.
Do you
I have no idea.
Serial numbers?
Like, yeah.
Serial number?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, well, I mean, like, how you, yeah, I suppose that's true. Like, how you refer to the thing, that's right. Probably figure outable. But
like, if you've got that one super valuable iMac G4,
right,
and because that was the prototype, but you've also got six others that are parts machines, how do you tell them, no, look for the one in the back that has the B after the number? They're like, yeah. I don't, they're all the same.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that's also kind of a problem if you're, you know, like, if you're trying to say, like, this is a, you know, this particular Apple II or something is important because, you know, whatever, it's got the raise power button or whatever. But I mean, the thing is that if you go and try to figure out a value for that, search Apple II on eBay, you know, that's going to give you nothing useful, you know, because
you could do an eBay listing in advance and stick it on the item and say, this on eBay, these are the words to use and you will get maximum value. If
Steve
I was selling
Jobs
it today,
rare.
Here's what I would type. Steve Jobs rare 1-1. Yes.
Yeah. I guess, you know, yeah, it seems like a good idea, just a sticker, something. Yeah. Especially if you have, I know you've, like, I saw you had like a wall of iMacs on your shelf there, Paul. And yeah, like one of them, if it's like, that was Steve Jobs' iMac, you know, but, right.
Right.
How do you, that's,
I think the bar for that should be high, though, right? Going back to what Carrington said about, like, what's precious to you is garbage to everyone else, and that line needs to be high. So if you've got a raised button Apple II that's worth 48% more than the other 2 million Apple IIs that were made, that's not high enough of a bar. Like, that's still garbage to everyone else, and it's not worth, for your bereaved loved ones who are dealing with your crap, it's not worth the $1,000 they might get on eBay for that one because it's a special Apple II. So, I mean, I think it pretty much has to be Mark Twain level of artifact before it's worth, you know, even leaving to somebody else. And I think that's easy to specify in a will. And the specification should be not necessarily that, you know, my children have to deal with this thing now. It could be that, hey, this thing is valuable. Give it to this club over here or whatever, or send it to the Computer History Museum or whatever. Like, this shouldn't necessarily just be passed down because it's valuable to you or it's rare. Because again, my grandchildren aren't going to care about a Mark Twain 2GS, no matter how precious it is to, you know, to me.
Though it is important that the Mark Twain 2GS itself is preserved because it is actually a unique item. So that's the, I guess, the other side of the coin. Some people do have things that really should be preserved.
Yeah, and all the more reason not to give it to your kids, because they're not going to do the right thing with it. They're going to leave it in the window next to the sun and let the floppies rot. And, you know, you need to give it to someone who knows how to preserve something like that.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, that's much more rare than the C65. I mean, there's like two, I think. I guess my, you know, now that we're, I just to say a little bit about the actual estate planning with, I hadn't, you know, like I have a friend of mine who runs, you know, Mac Rumors, like he is, you know, he knows a good bit about the different things. And I thought, okay, well, you know, my wife will reach out to him. I've got basically, I was looking at it, I've got basically 20, 21 systems set up and functioning. And I, you know, they're, turn them on and they work. They are, I don't have duplicates of anything. Like, I might have one or two parts machines on the shelf that's literally in two pieces, but I don't have a collection like Tony or Paul, you know, or, that kind of thing. Bigger than Carrington's.
Low bar.
You know, so, and so what it, like, given that, you know, I want to get this, and I think I'm going to probably create a list, but as Quinn says, you know, I think it's basically will be, you know, there's only a few things that really are worth, you know, actually taking some action and doing something with, because, yeah, you know, there's an Amiga there, but it's not special, you know, it's, there's nothing unique about it. And basically what I said until I get it settled was, you know, there's one machine, like I have an Apple Lisa too, you know, that is worth, you know, my wife maybe trying to get that sold for the money. It's rare, but there's others, you know, it's worth, there's some real money that can come from that. But for the rest, this is news to you guys, but I said, you know, anybody from the show that contacts me, that contacts, that wants anything, if they have a means to get it, they're welcome to it. And so that's like, and for the next year or so, I'm sure that's my plan. You know, so, but otherwise just, you know, I think it all could be let go. I don't have that enough of a unique collection, but, I'll probably end up listing three or four things that are unique, you know, and then the rest is sort of like, you know, it should be nice if someone used it, but it's not, you know, the world's not losing something if they go away.
Yeah, well, my wife and I were just recently discussing this. She asked me, oh, what's that delivery that just came in? So I told her about, you know, it's an Apple II Platinum. It's got all these cards in it. Her interest level started to plummet quickly. the thing I think is the takeaway from that is that she said, well, if you're not here, how am I going to tell the important junk from the rest of your junk? And so all I can say is, yes, stickers are good, but be careful what stickers you use, where you put them. That valuable model X, Y, Z, whatever it is, has just been devalued because a non-removable sticker was just put onto the delicate paintwork. But yeah, something, you need to do something. Now, I've got mostly a book collection rather than a computer collection. So, yeah, people are more used to handling books. But what I've been doing is progressively moving through my collection, scanning them and putting them up on the Internet Archive. I had originally thought of creating a blog, documenting them all. And that just seemed like too much hard work. So now all the scans are going up. So now I've got some uniquely Australian titles, computer related, not computer related, and getting them digitally preserved. I'm hoping the Internet Archive will continue on for a tad longer than myself. But the takeaway for us here is, there's nothing really valuable in the 8-bit bunker. There's some interesting machines. I've got Havoc 6502, of which I've only seen a few floating around the planet. So, you know, all of these things are basically, you know, my wife now has an understanding that when she's got over me going, and this is, of course, assuming that she outlasts me, some days it doesn't feel that way. But these pieces go to whoever, and then just have an open data community. Just tell them to come in, behave themselves, take what they like, and share it around. If it ends up on eBay or somewhere else, don't worry about it. I'm not. To me, it's the books. Books seem to be less interesting to the kids of today. I take great pleasure every time I upload something, even if it's something esoteric, as in the Victorian state government's 1942 How to Build a Bomb Shelter in Your Backyard booklet from World War II, or just recently a title called, what have we got here? The Bewildered Parent's Guide to Computer Programming, an Australian title that, I haven't seen it anywhere else. Now I'll go searching for it online and I'll be tripping over copies of it everywhere. But, getting those things online so that other people can enjoy them, catalogs and things, finding Dick Smith catalogs from the 80s were not really available or not fully scanned for electronics enthusiasts. And, you know, I've got in the two-way radio fraternity have been in contact with me saying, thanks for putting up the 1986 Dick Smith catalog. It's got all the extra bits and pieces for my radio system that I got from my uncle. I now know what I need to complete the set. We had so much good times together with this. And, you know, it's just those bits and pieces that, you know, sometimes you only find in a catalog and then you find out, guess what? That Dick Smith Cat extension, whatever it is, never actually made it to market. But that again is a piece of history, and I'll agree. The value of my computers plummets immensely every person you step away from me, and that's including the family. We've no kids. It's all going to go to the nephews and nieces, and they've expressed zero interest in computers.
You talked about scanning there. I think that goes back to what Carrington was saying about the Swedish death cult or whatever it was, that the more you can reduce this stuff before you die, the better.
Reducing. No, I scan the books. I keep the books. I get more books. Well, and more books means more scanning.
Well, but if the books are scanned, then on your deathbed, you can send them all to the recycler and not worry because the books have been preserved. And I think going back to what other people said about putting stickers on things, I mean, another solution to that problem is, well, you don't need 6 Commodore 64s, you know, just keep the one that's valuable, you know, assuming you don't pass on very unexpectedly, you're probably going to have, you know, a couple of months of notice to start getting rid of that stuff too. I think that is another approach.
Mind you, all those books would make a great funeral pyre. Or am I getting a little bit Ray Bradbury Fahrenheit 451 here?
I guess you could look at your collection and try to decide what do you have because it's an investment. Like, you've got this thing that has value and you think will retain its value, which is almost nothing in vintage computers, by the way. But let's say you have that. And then separate from that, you have the collection that you enjoy. You have these things because you love them. They bring you value. Like, I've got my iMac G4. Love it. Play games. It's terrific. But it's not a thing that I have because I think it's going to accumulate in value. It's just a thing I have because I love it. So maybe that's a way to separate them. Like, which of these things is actually going to be worth more money later? And those are the things to make sure that your family knows, because they don't have to deal with it right away then. Say, take these 5 items, stick them in a box. 10 years from now, feel free to sell them. They'll be worth more then. The rest of your stuff won't be.
Mm-hmm. And again, I think that bar should be high. Like, $2,000 is probably not high enough for someone to deal with the hassle of shipping a CRT to someone on eBay. Like, don't underestimate how much of a hassle that is for someone who doesn't want to do it and who just lost someone they love. So, I mean, I think somewhere maybe a Lisa 2 or something that valuable is above that line. But, yeah, it's a pretty high bar, I think.
Yeah, I fully agree.
It's all such big, heavy things in our – like, if it was baseball cards, $2,000 baseball card, fantastic. Stick it in a book and you're done. But a $2,000 Lisa setup is a bunch of space and a bunch of weight to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wonder if there's a service that should exist. Sean Fahey should go into this and say, you just send entire collections to me, I sell it, I keep half the value. Bing, I deal with it for your family. I know what it's worth and I know who to sell it to. Done. Somebody should just go into that business, somebody who knows what they're doing. And then what do we do with his collection, though? Oh, it never ends.
It's called Kansas Fest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I mean, this is what I was kind of thinking, you know, as people were talking, that, like, it seems like actually the right thing to do, if you can work it out, is to designate somebody, or maybe a list of somebodies that you go down, you know, to the first one that is, you know, outsurvived you, and say, like, this is the person who will be able to evaluate this stuff. You go grieve over here. This person will look at the stuff and tell you and will report.
But are they local? Like, how do they deal with it?
Yeah. I mean, like, so then the question is, do we, as a community, do this for each other, you know, say, I will be your, you know, buddy, your death buddy, or whatever.
RetroDeathBuddies.com.
Yeah.
Blake,
I was going to suggest Retro Computing Godparent is a little a little nicer than Death Buddy. But...
Well, Death Buddy could always forward them through to the Retro Godparent, so.
Yeah. But I mean, the other thing too is that a lot of what we're talking about is stuff that you sort of plan through the process of time, and it's not really, you know, it's not really taking into account this bus factor, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, the thing is, what happens if 17 days from now or whatever, you know, you're no longer able to do, you know, to interact with people and designate things, or, you know, breathe or whatever, So,
well, if you find out you have very little time left, you might not want to spend it cataloging your collection. Yeah. So maybe doing that when you're healthy and you think you're not going to die forever is the time to do it, so that you don't have to worry about doing that. Well, I got 2 weeks left. Ah, better get scanning.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And that's a Scheherazade thing, that if you leave your stuff half scanned, you can never die. Oh, can't die because I got to scan this. This will always be halfway through scanning something, and you're immortal.
Yeah. Every time you scan something, you get younger. No, I was thinking more along the lines of a garage giveaway. So as the people file into the chapel to say farewell to me, there'll be a grab table down the side where they can pick up a piece, and then we can have a blind auction, a silent auction at the wake.
That's great. Sorry for your loss. Thank you. Here's your joystick. And they move on to receive your
Everything is funeral garage sale.
everything you do take is accompanied by a mandatory imitator too.
The person who gives the best eulogy gets first pick.
That's right.
Have any of us done any of this? I mean, like, I should say, I know it's a good idea, and I have done like none of it.
The best time to do it? Yesterday. Might as well do it today. But it's overwhelming. You look at it and you go, well, where do I start? I'm with Quinn. When I'm gone, it's not my problem. But that's the thing. I don't like. That's my
radical interpretation of the text.
Yeah, that's my takeaway. Quinn says it's not my problem. But no. I want to make sure that some of the stuff does go to where it belongs, and the rest, yeah.
Some is too vague a number. I think you have to say three of the stuff. Pick three things. That's what you can pick. Whatever your three things are, pick those. That's it. Or one per person you're leaving things to.
Yep.
Everything else is a burden.
Pick
your three things. You could do that this afternoon. Pick three things. It can change later. These are the three things I care about.
Actually, it's not such a silly idea. Just thinking it now, there literally is three things which I would like down here within a long arm's reach to actually get to someone who appreciates them, you know, at least half as much as I do. The rest, interesting talking points. Yeah, there's, you know, couple of dozen people who would sort of like have a fun couple of hours rooting through the bunker here, and then the rest can just join me on the pyre. Has EPA got rules against burning retro material? Is it pollution?
Almost, it pretty much ought to. Yeah. I mean, I know that thinking about the things that I have, I mean, many of the things I think of as kind of transient, you know, like I have the thing because I want to scan the thing, and then I don't want to have the thing anymore. So it does not clear that it goes on a list, but at the same time, it might be something that, you know, maybe isn't quite up to the threshold of putting a sticker on, but it's still, you know, people would much rather have it than have it be dumpstered. So I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, it's something I am reminded that I need to think about. So
I guess weird way to think of it is, if you are, say, like Paul, like say you're collecting a bunch of material that you want to archive, and you have it because you want to scan it and preserve it. If you keep collecting things and not scanning them or releasing them, you're actually doing a disservice to the community at large, because you're a single point of failure. So you brought all these things in and then you died and all got thrown in a dumpster. Whereas if you said, I'm only going to take in things as quickly as I can scan them, any point where you fail, you just, oh, Paul's dead. What a bummer. It would be a bummer. I would miss you. Just for the record.
Okay.
But then it'd be like, oh, the five things you were working on are the most that could be lost, in a sense. But of course, if you didn't get them by them on eBay, if everyone did that, they would all just got thrown out ahead of time. So maybe you actually delayed the inevitable. I don't know. I have no idea what the solution is. Be a minimalist.
Yeah. I have come to realize exactly that, you know, and it took me a while to get to that point, but I have a lot
of
stuff.
Which point I wasn't sure I made a point.
Oh,
did I get to a point
that the things are coming in, but they're not getting processed.
Oh, I see. Right. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yes.
And you know, what good is it in my filing cabinet, you know, for 7 years? So anyway, it's unfortunate that it takes an event like this to really kind of bring that home. But, nevertheless, it's it is worth having it. It's good that it was brought home.
Do something today before some notable in your community passes away unexpectedly.
So have you solved it? Have we solved the problem?
I think we could do without lots of timely reminders, but we should get off our collective backsides and actually do something.
I got that couch. I don't know what else you want from me.
You, well, okay, your backside must be comfy because you said the couch isn't.
It's not.
Hmm. I'm looking at that turntable, Carrington.
I'm getting a new turntable. I don't know what I'm going to do with this. My life is turned upside down. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. You should scan it.
Get a microphone and you'll have two and a microphone.
Yeah, I do not need two turntables and a microphone.
Isn't that what it's called, stereo? One album for each ear?
Okay. I guess we can move on to listener feedback. There is a bit of that that I could talk about if we want to, you know, leave the somber stuff behind a little bit and move on to less somber things. All right, thumbs up from
Let's
Quinn.
Do that.
Okay. Tony wrote over email to talk about a port of Prince of Persia to the Atari. Basically, what's happened here is that someone has taken the source code for Prince of Persia and ported it to the Atari, and so that's an interesting project. I'm not sure if it's done yet. I didn't get far enough to looking into that. Does anyone know what I'm talking about?
I saw it, but I haven't didn't dig in.
Oh, I'm aware of what you're talking about, but no. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see.
Yeah,
it's cool that it's a port and not a re-implementation, because you see a lot of those, like, oh, I made Halo for the Commodore 64 or whatever, but this is like they actually took the source code and ported it, you know, and just updated the graphics routines and so on. So the gameplay should feel the same as it does on other platforms, which is really cool.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see. I saw it pass. I don't know anything about the current status, but it, you know, as we know, it came, and as you may have just mentioned, it came, you know, it was ported to the Commodore 64 when the source code was revealed, what, like 2 years ago? Something like that. And it'll be interesting to compare the Atari with the Commodore because, you know, they're different architectures. They both have pluses and minuses. So, yeah.
I think the Atari is actually closer to the Apple II than the Commodore is, though.
I would agree. And unlike the Commodore, I know as an example, it can't do artifacting, whereas the Atari used, you know, color artifacting for a lot of it, as the Apple II does for all of it. It'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. But of course, one of the things that brings up is that the reason this is possible is that Jordan Mechner's parents found a bunch of discs in his closet that had the source code on this, and that's one of the things that Tony Diaz was sort of like briefly famous about, was going with Jason Scott to Jordan Mechner's house to sort of like dig through these discs and revive the source code. So the reason that this port is possible is because the source code was made available. So yes, we can link to the port thread on Atari Age, but also to a couple of things about the Prince of Persia source code salvage, including Tony's Kansas Fest 2012 presentation. That was 2012. That was a long time ago. Mm-hmm. Now.
That source code is a great read too if you're interested in 6502 code at all, because it's rare that you get to see a full commercial product that was implemented in 6502, and this is like how we structured it. Here's how the art assets are loaded, and here's how the animation routines, you know, are synchronized. Like it's extremely well commented, this code, so it's actually quite easy to read and see how he did everything. And I think it's, you won't find a better education on how to write a large scale like AAA game in a 6502 environment, I think, than that source code.
Yeah, I've been meaning to look through it. I know when it was first released, I looked through just the booting code and realized, you know, discovered that it was, that there are a couple of little Easter eggs in there where, you know, like if you start it up and do the right thing, then you can make your disk drive sound like a motorcycle, you know, stuff like that. He had this strange thing that would, I think it read the paddle, so it would see like where your joystick was or where your paddle was, and you could sort of increase and decrease the speed of the rattling of your disk drive to make it sound like a motorcycle. I don't know. They probably don't release things like that on modern games, but
I can't really see someone making their SSD rattle to. I never played Prince of Persia in the original thing, so I think I'm going to go down this rabbit hole later on and play Prince of Persia for the first time on the Atari. Emulators ahoy.
I think, Paul, on my modern PC, there are some games, and if you tweak just the right graphics setting, it will control how much hot air blows out of the back of the tower.
like a motorcycle.
you know, you change the detail settings and more hot air comes out it and it gets louder, you know. Yeah, it's kind of cool.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Let's see, what else? Sean sent email. So we had been recently talking about networking and network games and stuff. And back in January, Sean had sent us a spreadsheet of networkable Mac games. And I think we mentioned it, but it was just, you know, it was just sort of like, I don't think the spreadsheet is actually available anywhere. It's a very big spreadsheet with many games that are sort of like playable on network Macs. And I don't know if Sean's actually going to make this available somewhere, if he just emails it to anyone who asks him for it. but it is kind of a it's a bigger list. I think that was the thing that we said before when he sent it, is it's a kind of a bigger list than I expected, you know, of things that you can play on Mac, sort of Mac networks, and, you know, from sort of like the 80s and 90s. So, but anyway, he wrote not to tell us that again, but actually to mention that he's been scanning some magazines, and specifically Mac Format magazine. He's been scanning and putting on Macintosh Garden, and I don't know Mac Format magazine, but that's kind of that is kind of neat in and of itself. You know, that this is a magazine that I won't have read before. Has anyone seen this magazine before?
No.
The title's familiar, but I wasn't really into Mac's back around that era.
It's apparently British, which might be why none of us have heard of it.
Okay.
Yeah, well, that's probably why I'm aware of it, because the British mags got here a bit more timely than the American mags. Yeah, the American mags was like was like reading things more than a quarter out of date, and considering that things were already effectively out of date when they went to print.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of amazing how the news cycle has shortened. You know, that it used to be possible to read something in a magazine that was produced a month before you read it, and it would still be like news.
Yeah, it's still news. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure Mac Format was available here in Canada. We would get a lot of British magazines, so I'm fairly certain that was on our newsstands and would be bagged with floppies or whatever. I'm pretty sure that was something that was available here locally. Though it would be a British, it wouldn't be reprinted. It would be like just the British version. We would get a lot of British tech mags. I'm pretty sure that was here.
Yeah, there was a book. It was one of the book. I remember about the time Borders went out of business. Before it, it was a Best Buy sort of thing, but it was computer related. Does anyone remember the name? It went out of business around like 98, 99, computer something, or I can't remember the name, a big chain. At any rate, they imported a number of UK magazines, and Mac Format was one. And I when they did a closeout, I remember I grabbed. They had several months, so I think I have a few lying around. It was
well, that last one that you were just scrolling past gives it away as being British. The real Judge Dredd, yes.
Yeah, anyway, it's interesting. These are later than the magazines that I tended to read. You know, I was a big consumer of magazines probably 6 or 7 years before this, but. But it's nice that they're being preserved. So so if you're interested in this or you know, just wanted to see what the people across an ocean from you were reading, if you are across the ocean from Britain, then there you go. Okay, let's see. Tony sent over email just pointing out specifically Bill Mensch's VCF West presentation on the evolution of the 6502. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes. But also, there are other VCF West presentations, too. So if you're interested in the presentations from VCF West, check out YouTube. You can probably get there from the link to Bill Mensch's talk that will be in our show notes. So, okay, that's good enough. Now I guess we can move to items of interest in news. Blake is not present.
I'm back.
Okay.
You mentioned his name and summoned him.
Well, you don't have to go first, but you are alphabetically first.
Okay, I'm prepared. I have one item. It seems as if, based on the items I've been discussing in the previous shows that I've attended, that I can't really let this one slide without a mention. So over at the Big Mess O'Wires, I think I've mentioned this every. I think my last four shows have had some kind of update on the Yellowstone disc controller card that Steve over there has been working on. There have been different phases, different updates as far as its readiness. I think the last show, it was almost completely ready to go. Now Steve mentions that I am happy to say it's finally working. He's got a video demonstrating this device, and it's just for those that haven't heard my five previous mentions of this. It's a disc controller card that will control, I think, every Apple 3.5-inch drive that's ever been created, except for the original 400K Macintosh drive. So anything else, like if it's whether it's in an enclosure outside or it's, you know, something that's an internal drive that you've got wired up. So he's asking for beta testers now. This was 2 days ago, I think. So I don't know. He said he didn't have, there aren't that many test units, but if you're interested and you have the, you know, the right hardware that he's looking for, you can make contact and possibly get a beta unit. So it sounds like these are going to ship rather soon after the final tests. And so, yeah, if you're looking for a crazy flexible disc controller card, there you go. So that is about it for that.
On the last show, you guys, there was some conversation around, like, who is this for? Like, what problem is this solving? A use case that wasn't mentioned was for, honestly, 2GS users. I think this is a great thing because non-GS users might not know this, but that there's like five Apple II 3.5-inch drives that look identical. And like, yeah, two of the five work on the GS out of the box. And you have to know the minutiae of these drives to know which ones work and which don't and why. And I think some of them will even like fry something if you plug them in. Like, it's kind of a big deal for these 3.5-inch drives because Apple made a whole bunch of different ones that all look identical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I think you're not exaggerating when you say that.
I've got a 3.5-inch drive for my Apple IIc, and I'm actually scared to plug it into anything else.
It seems like we're a little better protected in the modern era with modern things from plugging stuff in that will fry. But you know, everything used the little D15.
Yeah, the good old days where the same sockets were used for vastly incompatible devices.
Yeah.
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 And on the same machine, some things can be unplugged and some can't, you know, and I think that's one of the most prominent forms of progress that we've made in technology is hot plugging is now assumed and it's basically always safe.
Oh, no, the old machines, we always had hot plugging. It's just that normally they burst into flames.
The extra hot.
I mean, you had to be a subject matter expert to know that the serial port is okay to unplug and the drive port will ruin your machine if you unplug it, like things like that.
All right. And Carrington has stuff.
I have a quick one. I don't know if we talked about this back a month and a half ago when it got announced that it was going to be sold at auction. I don't think I mentioned it then because I figured, well, why not mention it when it's up for sale? And then I missed the sale and now it's already sold. So you missed your opportunity unless you're the one who bought it. Apple prototype of a VideoPad 2. Now, there was a VideoPad 1 and a VideoPad 3. None of this actually got released, but the only ones ever shown to the public were the prototypes of the VideoPad 1 and VideoPad 3. And then this super secret VideoPad 2 emerged recently and then got put up for auction. It's already sold through Bonhams, sold for $14,025. Actually, speaking of our it kind of harkens back to our initial topic about the things you have that might be valuable. This is a one-of-a-kind hand-built prototype, only one in the world, and it sold for $14,000. So, you know, there's the Apple One stuff, hundreds of thousands. There's one-of-a-kind prototypes, and then there's everything else, which is $10. So, like, if you have things like this, you should pass this on to your family. So it's kind of neat. You can see that it's from that 90s era of Apple production. It's got the gray of the PowerBooks, has a real PowerBook kind of feel to it. It's weird in that there's a lid that is a different size than the base. So This is an odd prototype. It's got a little hole that I think is for a stylus to rest in. And then on the screen appears to be a small, probably 320 by 240 resolution screen for video conferencing with a camera above it, probably a quick take quality camera. This would have had battery that would have lasted in the minutes, I'm sure, and probably weighs 19 pounds. But it's interesting because it's clearly like something that would come after the Newton message pad. This is a grandchild of the message pad and has PowerBook genes in it as well. Mm-hmm. And then Steve Jobs came back and said, all of this is a distraction. And this was among the things that just got canceled when he came back. But it's kind of neat to see it because this is something that was never shown to the public before. So the version 2 of the video pad recently sold at auction. So I'll have a link if you want to look at the photos.
Interesting. It's not, it to me, it doesn't look, the industrial design is oddly unattractive in my reckoning based on as compared to other Apple devices. Is it happen to be indicated as to whether or not it was created by the Newton group, if that still existed at this time?
Yes. Yeah. Well, nobody seems to know, but everyone thinks this came out of John Sculley made a sketch of what he thinks the next version should be. And then the Newton group created this prototype. I don't even know if it's functional. This might be just a casing. Who knows?
In fact, where the screen would be, it appears to be empty. Like it's just a recess there. So
That's what it looks like to me. I was trying to figure out what's going on there.
I kind of like the industrial design.
I like how the camera has a cowling on the back. And these days, the phones have basically gone in totally the opposite direction, so as to fit it in. The lens pops out now rather than the camera workings out the back, but also it might just be streamlined for better aerodynamics.
Funny to think, since this is a really early prototype, this was them dreaming of what they could possibly do, and even they could only think it's got to be 2.5 inches thick or whatever. Even their wildest dream, and the actual production item would have been heavier and bigger than this. So it's crazy that even in their fantasies, they couldn't imagine something thinner than this.
Yeah, their wildest dream is still kind of lame.
It's funny because this looks like a fake almost. Like it's reminded me quite a lot of. I think we've talked about NanoRaptor, who posts like funny Photoshop mockups of like things that never existed, like this I've got on the screen. I think I may have put this on the screen before too, but it's a PowerBook Duo that is itself a dock for another Duo.
It's Duos all the way down.
Yeah, but it does. It looks quite a bit like this prototype.
Yeah, right.
This does look like something from that channel. Other people might know that or that Twitter for the L shaped monitor.
Oh, the L shaped monitor.
Portrait and landscape all in one.
Now, the first time I saw this, I wanted to know what movie did it come from. It just struck me as a prop that people walking around with their portable video conference stylus, tablet of the day. And all I can say is thank God that movie didn't come to fruition, or that reality, I should say.
For me, it's just some of the interesting choices. The embossed Apple logo is off to the left rather than centered. Like there's so many things here where seem odd design choices for the period. I actually dig the design. I don't know if I would have ever wanted one of these, but
it actually kind of looks a little bit like the Newton group was involved, in putting this together. This has a Newton flavor, even if it has a PowerBook Newton-y styling.
I was assuming that.
Yeah, it's features chucked in so that they can agree to remove them as a concession and keep the bit that they wanted.
Yeah, I'm assuming the screen on the bottom is a Newton screen, I'm assuming, because it appears to be the right aspect and it looks like a black and white touch screen.
Yeah. So I'm just imagining how well this whole section has played for the audio-only listeners, and I am sorry for my... I thought we were going to be in and out real quick on this one, sorry.
I've never heard of the video pad. This is the first. And like this might is this like the Sam Coupe? I mean, is this fake?
No, because
Bingo
this card, was an actual
Sam Coupe mention.
Bingo.
All right. I guess we can move to the next thing, which is Michael's.
Well, mine is just more of, I just came across it during the week that, it's 50 years of Unix. And from Unix, we have the Nix family. And now I was just wondering, so like, that's really retro. And how has Unix and Nix played through your life? Both retro and modern. My first contact with Unix itself is actually relatively recent, more recent than the Linux offspring. In my day job, I actually work with several Linux servers for doing the stuff that allows me to buy more retro stuff that my family won't appreciate. But Linux, I've been using for a lot longer. I would wait for magazines to arrive so that I could get the cover-mounted CDs of a distribution of Linux so that I could try it out, because, we're talking about back in the day where you did not download ISO images of anything. If you could, you were some fancy rich person with or access to a work ISDN connection, because I wasn't doing it on my 56K modem.
Well, that's why you go to university, right?
Right.
To get that T1. Sweet, sweet T1.
Ah, I thought it was to be educated. Yeah, T1 connections all the way. Yeah, didn't even have T1s at work. But I was just wondering, so like, how has Unix and the Nix family been with you through your retro and your current careers? Do you use Unix? Do you work daily with Linux?
Linux annoys me because I feel like it kind of, I'm going to get a lot of hate mail for this, but I feel like Linux ruined Unix because it fragmented it really badly. Like,
yes!
So I grew up using
BSD.
No hate mail for me.
I grew up using BSD Unix, and it was this beautiful standard, and it was this, and Mac OS frankly stuck pretty close to it. But now Linux, I use Linux a lot at my day job, and any knowledge I have from Mac OS, it translates very poorly to both Ubuntu or Red Hat, both of which we use. And like all of these different things, they put files in different places, and the architect, like the package managers are completely different. Like they're basically all completely different OSs that just happen to have, they all have LS and CD and like, for basic file navigation. But aside from that, there's very little in common between them.
And POSIX
very
is
annoying.
A lie.
Yeah. Yeah. Now I miss the days of you could sit down and assume it was BSD and it would, everything you knew would just work.
Mm. I can say my first experience with a Unix was Linux. A Unix like thing was Linux when, oddly and probably not the typical first run, but I ran it on the desktop and I installed it from 14 floppy disks. This was in 1995. But in most of my jobs since, there's been some sort of, whether it's Linux on a server or I ran a CMS on Solaris, so that was a Unix and now, there's like a little bit of Linux. But yeah, it's I think the only retro machines I have that of course the Mac is Unix, as you know, I've got a number of those around, modern Macs, but I guess the Next and HP 9000 are my only Unix machines that I actually use every now and again.
Some say Blake is still installing those floppies.
Yep.
Yeah, that was the experience.
Yeah, I think I my Linux experience is really just from trying to get web servers doing what they're supposed to do. I feel like I've dipped my toe into a couple of different distributions. Red Hat was the one, Red Hat CentOS or however, I don't know how you say these things out loud, of course, but, these are the ones that, I mostly used for servers, but now that I've been spending more time with the Raspberry Pi and trying to get it to do server-like things, now I'm trying to do Debian, and it's true that like things are not all the same. And then none of it is the same as what my Mac does. But
I find that worse. When things are very different, it's easier for me to keep them straight. When something is almost kind of sort of like something else, I make all kind of mistakes. Yep. I'll just fall into the wrong hat. Oh, wait, no, that's not there. Those files are there. And that's worse.
That's what gets me, because I do a lot of continuous integration deployment management at my day job, and so we're using Jenkins and things like that. And when you Google the problems that you're having, you find series of command lines that, oh, this will fix that problem, and you do them and they don't work, and you're like, why isn't this working? It's like, oh, I'm on Ubuntu and they're on something else, and so you start Google my Jenkins problem with plus Ubuntu, and it's like, oh, there's some Ubuntu instructions. Type those in. Those don't work. Oh, it's for Ubuntu 16, but they changed the package manager back in 13. And it's,
Even little subtle things like you're trying to just do a regex search on something, or you're piping something on the command line, and you're like, oh, well, okay, I'm looking this up. They're using, Z shell. I'm using Bash, or this is C shell. They're almost the same, but they're slightly different. And then for me is, again, with servers that run it, these would be web servers. You're like, okay, where does this keep the logs? Where are the web logs? Are they split into multiple, or is it the one? And it's just different based on the default configuration. And, yeah, so I think, Carrington, kind of your point, they're similar but a little different, and that does make it difficult.
So basically, Unix are upstanding and stable, responsible members of the community, but they've let their kids run rampant.
They didn't understand what was valuable.
No,
yeah,
they
exactly.
Had. So use your stickers.
Yeah, the kids do interesting things, the kids do great things, but they're out of control. Oh, that was interesting. It never dawned on me that Unix, was it November 3, 50 years old, 50 years young.
Yeah,
that's
the epoch gets closer and closer.
Yeah.
Brandon in the chat said, I've been playing with Solaris on a 32-bit Spark for the last couple of years, and some things are so nice that part of me wishes the commercial Unix was more of a thing, until I spent an afternoon figuring out why the license server for my C compiler stopped working, and then I was over it.
Yeah. That's fair. Yeah. That's fair.
I hear that.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, that's what I love about modern macOS, is that it's Unix without all of some of that nightmarish stuff. Like, it's Unix with a window manager that doesn't suck, right? Because that's like, for as nice as 70s Unix and 80s Unix was, as soon as they got into GUIs, like X Windows is a disaster, a nightmare, hellscape. So yeah, macOS kind of puts a nice shine on all that stuff.
Yeah, I've always been particularly happy about the way, macOS uses cups as the printer, as the print server, but it does it in such a, you just don't feel it, like one of the things about running Linux on the desktop was, printing, like it was always, it wasn't, did not feel at all like you were directly printing. It definitely felt like you were, feeding this to the print server that you hope is running. I mean, again, I haven't run Linux. I mean, I run Raspberry Pi. I haven't tried to print from any of my 6 Raspberry Pis, but yeah, Apple covers the printing thing real nice, which is
BSD didn't really transition to the desktop, and even Linux hasn't really made that transition properly, and that's where macOS really shines, is that it brought all of that technology to the modern desktop with all of those quality of life improvements, like abstracting away printing and all that kind of stuff, for sure.
I have a Raspberry Pi doing serving as a scan, sort of like a scan station thing, and I'm pretty impressed with it, actually. I mean, I've got it set up in such a way that it's not, it's mostly invisible. I've programmed it to respond to the buttons on the scanner, so I can just say, hit the button and it'll do this thing, and then it'll upload it to Dropbox, and then I can download it from Dropbox on my Mac, and I'm pretty pleased with.
And the best part about it is that if you wanted to, you could actually fit the Raspberry Pi into the scanner.
Yep.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, Raspberry Pi is an interesting edge case of all this, because there you're mostly dealing with download this disk image, and it's an entire world that's pre-configured and works. Mm-hmm. So I run Octoprint on my 3D printer, and it's the same way. I downloaded an SD card image and plugged it in, and it loads up this perfectly configured window manager, and everything just works. And, it's an entire full desktop Linux system that 12-year-old me would have killed for just to run my 3D printer. It's kind of cool that way. But outside of that use case, not a fan.
Yeah. So on strange things with Raspberry Pis, I'm having lots of fun at the moment. I've got a Raspberry Pi hooked up to the HDMI of a monitor, and I'm actually driving the Pi via a serial connection, playing with the frame buffer to then display directly to the monitor via HDMI. I'm hoping to get it to a working stage where that basically becomes a plug-in HDMI monitor for any retro computer. But they're such flexible little devices. And as you said, you just download an image onto the SD card and just magic happens. I love it.
Mm-hmm. The Raspberry Pi Zero W is a wonderful thing, as a concept, because it's like a cheap little thing. It has wireless in it. Only problem is you can't get them anymore. if anyone has tried.
Well, it's because the version 2 has been released.
I love this. There's a Raspberry Pi Zero 2.
Yep.
W.
Yep.
But
Raspberry Pis need Steve Jobs to come back and just clean all this up.
That's right.
Product fragmentation is out of hand.
All right, let's see. I have the next thing. It is just this was actually sent. I know about this because Tony sent it to us over email. It is the National Museum of Computing is having a 40th anniversary of the BBC Micro event at the end of this month, so it's November 30th, and they are sort of bringing together experts from the sort of the development of the BBC Micro to talk, have a discussion and a Q&A. It is, I think it's both online and in person, so that means those of you who are not local to the TN Mock can also go. And I'm interested in it. I'm not sure. I haven't actually clicked the get tickets button to figure out how much they cost or anything like that. But it's an interesting milestone. Everything was such a long time ago now. Anyway, so if you're interested in that, this was a computer that had a huge impact, not in the place I was, but certainly in the place it was. So, and as I have repeatedly said, I had one for a summer. It was an NTSC one, and they're super hard to find. I would love to have that back.
I didn't know there were NTSC BBC Micros.
Yeah. I mean, like, I didn't know that they were sort of unusual or rare or whatever when I had it for the summer. It just seemed like the computer I was borrowing. But turns out it was one of not very many. I think Carrington, you said that you had come across them in Canada, but...
No, it was the ZX Spectrum. No, sorry, the ZX 80 and 81 were sold.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we had those for sure. Yeah, I knew a couple of people that had those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those super powered computers. That was enough for Canada. We couldn't handle any more power, and those keyboards were all we needed.
That's right.
They would work in the snow.
Anyway, okay, that was it for my item.
I have to add, now that you mention it, it hadn't occurred to me to mention this, but now that you mentioned the BBC Micro and the anniversary, mm-hmm. There I listened to a number of podcasts other than retro computing, and some of them are sort of some mystery podcasts, a lot of true crime, but there's this one podcast called Astonishing Legends, and they talk about Bermuda Triangle or like the Somerton Man, the
NTSC BBC Micro.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, there's this article in there's this
the
article
Chupacabra of computers.
The Vertical Plane, it's a two-part, and it's interesting because I've tweeted about this recently, but I'm just going to give a real small nutshell. What it is there is basically, and I think it took place, I'm not remembering the time, like in the 70s, no I guess the 80s, because the BBC Micro, early 80s, mm-hmm. Guy had a word processor, BBC Micro, that he worked at a university, he had it at home, and they mentioned the software it used, a word processor, I can't remember the name of it. All of a sudden there's a file on it, and it's a letter to the person whose house it was in, but it was written like hundreds of years before, and it was someone that had lived in that house, but it was written as if they were living there simultaneously. both in the past and this other person in the present. Like they were aware that they were there. It was a strange back and forth. And so the modern, the 80s person and the 100-year-old person were writing letters to each other, sort of complaining about each other's presence in the house on through this BBC micro. And of course, you know, it's rather fanciful, but it's an interesting thing to listen to. And there was, you know, the people that run the show, it's a great show. They're not highly, you know, tech folks. And I tweeted a response to some of the things that were said. And so they reached out and we had a back and forth. I gave a little BBC Micro history, but it's interesting. So if you're a BBC Micro fan and you entertain the notion that there could be time traveling ghosts that communicate through a BBC Micro, then by all means, give a listen to this astonishing Legends Vertical Plane episode.
It's cool.
I had never seen a mystery quite framed in this way. So.
Yeah, I guess that is kind of it's a funny use of technology. It's pretty cool. There's a movie, The Lake House, I think. Had a premise like this, right?
Right. I think so. And I remember there were some books that my wife read in her youth, and they were on the shelf. I read them, called Sabine's Notebook. And it was like kids' books, and it was as if, right, there are two people, they went to the same place, but they weren't there, you know, in each other's presence, that kind of thing. Two worlds, yeah. I think you're right about the lake.
Oh, like Secret Garden stuff, yeah.
So, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of the details are, it's an interesting set of episodes to listen to. I'll leave it at that. But,
cool.
Yeah.
By the way, end of the line, Joel in our chat says, NTSC version of the Acorn BBC Micro basically had RF shielding put in place and the screen resolution dropped from 640 by 256 to 640 by 200. It's possible I knew that about the screen resolution because the only thing I ever did on it was, I think I never had any storage for it, so I would turn it on, I would program something, and then it would be gone, you know, when I turn it off. And so I would play a little bit with, like, doing the graphics, and I think that's what I do remember, is that there was something funny about the vertical resolution. Like, the examples weren't always working.
For those tickets, £7.50 plus fees, so looking at about £9, whatever that converts into your local currency. So I'll be there.
Now, that is quite affordable.
Mm.
Okay, let's see. Quinn, you have the next thing.
Yeah, hang on. I'm just putting a sticker on my NTSC BBC micro.
Right.
All right. Moving right
Do
along.
Do not give to Paul.
Yes. So what I have here is the 100 megahertz 6502, what they're calling the 65FO2. I assume the F stands for friendship. Or possibly fast or FPGA. I don't know. I like to say friendship. So we've seen so it's a pin compatible replacement for the 6502, and it's done with a Spartan 6 FPGA, which is really cool. So it can run at 100 megahertz. And what I love about this is that it's much better thought through than other 6502 accelerations that we've seen. So it behaves much more like the accelerator in the 2C+. Now, they are taking this pretty seriously in that they have actually tested this and developed it as a replacement in multiple 6502 systems. So we're talking Apple II, we're talking Atari, and we're also talking about a bunch of other strange things. So they tested it in, let me see here.
It's like a bunch of chess computers.
Yeah, chess computers and like other random, some video game handhelds and some other random things that happen to use 6502s. So there's a very long list of systems that they've actually tested this in. So this is not some half-baked thing. What's really cool is it has this automatic real-time mode. So the 2C+ accelerator, and I think also like the rocket chip and some other things, had this system where they would automatically detect memory accesses to certain critical areas that had to run at 1 megahertz. So on the Apple II, of course, this means the paddles and the ROM wait timing loop and, of course, the floppy drive. So, you know, most accelerators fall down in the Apple II in those areas, but this thing does not. And it's got an automatic system that detects those and then slows down and then goes back up to full speed when it detects that you've left the subroutine that was using those areas of memory, which is pretty clever. So I like that design. And the way that they made it universal is also very clever. So it's got, because all these 6502 systems might use the same CPU, but they all map memory completely differently. You know, an Atari 800 and an Apple II have completely different memory maps. So they have pre-programmed the memory map for every system that they can find that uses a 6502. And then it's just got a bunch of DIP switches on top of it so you can choose your memory map. So you just set that and it knows what kind of system it's in. So it knows where the graphics page is and so on, which I also love. And now they're going on to the next step. So they're developing, they have a video RAM mirroring system where it actually makes a copy of video RAM on the system that you're running it on. Again, it knows where that is. And video writes are done at 1 megahertz because they have to be on most of these systems. But video reads are done at full 100 megahertz because they can do that safely. So they cache a copy of video RAM and they mirror writes into both places. And so you can read video RAM at full speed, which, you know, little tricks like that to accelerate it. Very, very cool. So this thing is... it's awesome. It's not a commercial product. They say they're not sure if they're going to produce it as such, but it does seem to be a thing that you can buy in some quantity. So, I definitely recommend checking this out.
I wonder, so people are envisioning this as an accelerator. So like your chess computer, you know, you don't have to wait around for your chess computer to beat you.
Yeah.
Because another thing that occurs to me when I see this, I mean, so one thing it could be used for is like my 6502 broke. Let me put this in its place.
Yeah.
Another thing that occurs to me is there was a 65802, which is it's like a 65816, but in this form, you know, whatever it is, the 40-pin mm-hmm. form, and it was possible to put those in to like an Apple IIe or whatever and get access to 16-bit processing.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like this. It could be possible with something like this. Maybe that's too big of a leap. I mean, like it seems like it's a proof of concept that means that could be done.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think it seems like you could go quite a ways with this, like with this platform, because this is basically, it's an FPGA emulation platform for the 6502 that can do a lot of very clever things. So it seems like you could expand this quite a bit and do things like add opcodes even, or other things like that.
Cool. I can see this finding a home down here. The aforementioned Apple IIe Platinum that I recently acquired was to create a retro daily driver for I got sick and tired of doing my programming on an emulator and getting things to it. So I've got a machine now that I can just turn on, use. It has a virtual hard drive built into it, but it's only got, I shouldn't say only, it's got to the Fastchip 2E, so I can go up to 16.6 megahertz, and that is quite noticeable when you're programming.
It's very noticeable in Load Runner.
I had to post a video of Load Runner going screamingly crazy at 16.6. I was not even tempted a little bit to actually attempt to play it. I just thought, it's got an attract screen. I'm just going to run that at the max. But no, with this in the machine, hooked up and everything hooked up to the large 21-inch monitor, which 4:3 aspect, so it's not strangely stretched. No, I think this would be quite good because I'm actually enjoying sitting at a retro computer and programming in the day, rather than I'm enjoying it much more than using the modern tools and IDEs and then getting the disk image down to the machine.
Yeah. I'm wondering what I also wonder a little bit about the keyboards. Is it not the case that we have learned things about RSI and stuff like that since those days?
I think it's too late for me.
Too late. okay.
Leave Michael behind.
Yeah. What's cool about this device is that, so in your Load Runner example, Load Runner should in principle actually be playable. Like in your example, it's not just that Load Runner is running too fast for it to be, for it would be so difficult. It actually wouldn't be playable because, of course, the joystick code in the Apple II ROM doesn't work when it's accelerated because it's actually a cycle counted pulse counter. So the joystick inputs actually wouldn't even work, even if you could react quick enough.
Okay, so it's not unusable because it's going too fast. It's unusable because it can't be used.
Yeah, exactly. The code would fail because it can't count the pulses correctly at that speed. So in principle, this should work. Yeah.
I doubt the joystick issue is going to be much of a problem when I'm programming, though, because not writing games. Not writing arcade style games.
What are you doing with your life then, man?
I think this would be a great option for homebrew computer builders as well. If you want to build a 6502 homebrew, I think this thing would be an awesome choice for that.
Yeah. What do you know about homebrew computers, Quinn? Oh, wait.
Because it's actually pretty difficult to get a 6502 to run this fast. Out of the box, you can get them to run like 2 megahertz. You know, even the modern Western Digital ones that are still being made, the core just isn't capable of that much speed. So they've done some tricks here to get that core to run this fast. It's pretty clever.
That's very clever.
Yeah. Very cool. I think we actually did talk a little bit about this last time, but this is a better discussion. And the last time one hasn't actually hit the feed yet. I'm sorry to say.
Okay, cool.
Okay, yeah, I'll mark that page as I suggest to our listeners that they do. And as soon as I can get my hands on one, I'll let you know. But yeah,
this is really pretty disconcerting how dark it is now. The time just changed, and it's really noticeable.
Anyway. Obviously, there's something wrong with your side of the planet, guys.
I think so. Yeah.
Well, there might be because aren't I just like directly north of you? And I'm north, and it's not dark here yet. So there might actually be like a comet hitting you.
Okay. Well,
you might be in the shadow of something.
Quick, I'm going to run around
huge
and put stickers on things.
Yep.
On your forehead. There. Saved.
I think Carrington and Paul and I are in the same time zone, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Carrington time.
And yet, it's dark behind me.
Yeah, it's pretty dark out here.
So, as relevant as all this is, I'd actually like to move on to my second item, which is closely related. So, this one is interesting because it's a completely different approach than what I've seen before. So, it's billed as an Apple II accelerator. It's called the MCL65 Fast, and it is also a 6502 replacement. In this case, they're replacing it with a Teensy 4.1, which is a 32-bit ARM9 running at 800 megahertz. However, it is not what you think. It is actually not an Apple II accelerator or anything else. What they're actually doing is the Teensy is basically, it's an ARM processor that's blisteringly fast that happens to also support the Arduino ecosystem. So you can program it with the little Arduino C compiler to, you know, control your lights or whatever people do with Arduinos. But what they've done is they've interfaced it to the Apple II 6502 pin outputs. So really what it's doing is it's using the Apple II motherboard as an Arduino shield, if you like. And so he demonstrates, you know, displaying text by pushing bytes into, you know, that portion of video memory and reading keyboard input and so on. But it's not running the Apple II ROM code. It's not capable of running Apple II software. Obviously, you can't touch the disk drive at this speed. It's not slowing down for, you know, memory ports or anything. It doesn't know anything about the Apple II architecture. It's just saying, let's use the Apple II's 6502 socket as GPIO and put a Teensy on it, basically.
That's
and
a cool approach.
Yeah, it's very unusual and very interesting. So he's got some demos here of doing some very blisteringly fast things. But again, the Apple II is just sort of a zombie interface to video at this point. It's not involved in the process. It's participating against its will, so to speak, in this exercise. But it's neat.
It's like those cockroaches that get on top of like rats' heads and turn them into them. It's like one of those.
Yeah, yeah,
cool. How adorable.
Yeah.
Well, we've frequently talked about the idea of like basically nowadays you put like a faster computer inside the old computer. And this one goes, well, why don't we just then get rid of that old computer and just have this? So if you're writing for this, then you're not writing Apple II stuff. You're going to write using the Arduino tools.
So what he's done is he's implemented, for example, in this demo, he's implemented printf and scanf in standard C library as routines that know how to do those things by pushing characters into the character buffer on the Apple II and reading keyboard input from the input buffer. So it knows a little bit about the memory map of the Apple II, but it's not, as I say, it's not booting anything Apple II related. It's not running anything in ROM. It's just using the hardware for input and output, basically. Yeah, I think it's an Apple II motherboard shield for the Arduino.
Mm. Neat. That's I haven't seen anybody use this kind of approach before. This is very cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very weird and interesting. Yeah. Yeah, like if you needed, like, it's kind of a neat way to get full screen text input and output on an Arduino, because that, you know, that's something people normally do with like a serial port. But this is a different way to get that, I guess. So you could take this the next step and get actually high res graphics, you know, in Apple II style on your Arduino this way, I suppose, if you don't mind having an Arduino shield that's 20 times the size and weight of the Arduino board.
Right. Cool. Maybe you can get a replica Apple II that's smaller and connect that to your Arduino, and then it really is something of a, because it's their endeavor.
Yeah. It starts to get pretty navel-gazy at that point if you put your Apple I emulator replica board as an Arduino shield. So that it, yeah.
That would be pretty amazing, though, to actually, interface it with an actual Apple I. You know.
I suppose you could run an Apple II emulator on this ARM and then funnel the input and output through the real hardware. And then it would be an emulated Apple II running on real hardware. This is starting to hurt my brain.
Yeah. I wonder if you could sort of make the graphics memory map rational that way.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, you could remap things, I suppose. It reminds me a little bit of that demo that Peter Neubauer gave at Kansas Fest many years ago, where he had a Raspberry Pi using the Apple Pi adapter that puts a Raspberry Pi in a slot on the Apple II, and he was running a 2GS emulator on it that was then, so he had a 2GS running in his Apple II, basically. So he was running GS software on his Apple II, and it was all pretty seamless looking from the outside, but of course it's all smoke and mirrors. It's just the Raspberry Pi using the Apple II for power, basically.
Hmm. All right. Let's see. I think the only thing that's left in our show notes is another thing from you, Quinn, if you would like to talk about that.
I can roll right into that. So this is something that I don't feel gets quite enough play, honestly, in our community. And I'm definitely not scrambling here to share this tab and definitely not filling the dead air. So this came up somewhere. It's from a blog that I'd like to respect the name of, called the Raw Observatory. Presumably someone named Rob. Props for that blog name. So it's about the high cost of software. And we kind of think of software as being roughly the same cost throughout time. You know, software has always been sort of in the $30 to $60 range. But this guy actually sat down and did the inflation calculations on everything. And software has gotten much, much cheaper, like 50% cheaper. And if you include the production costs of software, it's probably gotten 100 times cheaper, which is really astonishing. So a baseline that people might recognize is Ultimo One, which retailed for $40 in 1981 or whenever that was. So in today's terms, that's about $110. And when you think that Ultimo One was written by one person, and wasn't it even written in BASIC, or was that just a Calabeth? Does anyone remember? Anyway.
I think it actually was written in BASIC, because Ultimo II was the thing.
Yeah, one was still in BASIC.
Okay, yeah.
And Ultimo II is when he learned how to use assembly language.
Okay, yeah, okay. So here we have this thing written by a teenager in BASIC selling for $110. And nowadays, you know, this was the AAA game of the day, and nowadays a AAA game would be retailing for about $60, so about half that. And the modern AAA game is like 300 people working for 5 years. So, you know, production costs have gone up 1,000-fold, and yet prices have somehow dropped 50%, which is pretty astonishing. I think we don't appreciate how expensive software used to be. And I'm not sure exactly how. I guess just because back then they could get away with it, frankly. I mean, it was supply and demand. People were willing to pay that for software. I don't have any.
I guess it was new. I mean, maybe because there wasn't anything like software. I mean, you can't really liken it to an. I don't think people would have felt, oh, this is the same as like an album or an 8-track tape. Maybe it's because it was such a new thing. It just, the computers are expensive. This must be expensive too. You know, maybe that's.
I think the AAA games are shifting different units in sales these days as well. But
yeah.
And then
economy of scale for sure. Yeah.
But yeah, when you are importing them to the Great Land Down Under, it used to be scaringly frightening expensive to get real games on media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's even worse than this because, you know, this is strictly an inflation calculator that he's used. And if you use something more sophisticated like a buying power calculator or what sometimes called the Big Mac Index, like how many Big Macs could a plumber buy in 1980 versus today, that encapsulates a lot of other factors like supply chain efficiencies and how salaries have actually gone up over time. People in the same job today actually make more money than they used to even at after inflation calculation because the economy has grown. You know, there's things like that. So where buying power is substantially higher today than it was back then, even accounting for inflation. So, you know, this $40 for Ultima 1 in 1980 was a huge chunk of someone's resources for the year to buy that, even without the inflation.
That's interesting. I had never thought about that in that way.
I thought about it when it comes to hardware, how much cheaper computing hardware is. I remember I was talking ages ago about how when a company of my family switched to desktop publishing, we bought a whole bunch of Mac 2CIs and 2CXs, like a bunch of like to fill a room, so like 20 or something like that. And I just looked it up, and like in 1989 when they came out, they were $6,269 just for the box. You buy the big Radius monitors and cards, and that's a $13,100 computer today. So imagine buying 20 $13,000 computers. And they say, okay, now you got to spend three times that for your monitors. It was insane pricing.
Right.
Like who buys a $13,000 computer anymore? That's just a generic desktop thing to do a little bit of desktop publishing on. It's bonkers how cheap things have gotten.
Yeah, I think we paid $3,500 for our Apple II Plus in 1982. And yeah, and with inflation, I don't know, what is that, like $7,000-$8,000 now, something like that? And that was our family's discretionary funding for, you know, a couple of years. Like that was a huge, that was like buying a car for us. Like that was a huge deal to buy that thing. And yeah, now people buy a new computer every year sometimes.
Yeah. And of course that's much less powerful than the Raspberry Pi Zero 2W.
Exactly. Yeah.
That runs a complete window manager just so it's a little more pleasant to talk to my 3D printer. So anyway, I thought that was a neat little rundown of the cost of software, and it speaks to piracy as well. Like, you know, piracy was, of course, extremely rampant back then, and this is frankly a lot of why. Like for a 14-year-old kid, like that was a huge amount of money to buy these games, and it's kind of a miracle that any of us managed to buy any of them. I mean, I bought a couple games, but I must have been saving my allowance for months and months and months to do that, you know, based on these prices.
You got to think of how many games were made by kids, teenagers, doing BASIC. The quality control wasn't awesome. Like, there was a lot of crappy games.
Yeah.
Like, imagine if you just bought all the games you pirated. Like, most of them were terrible. I've been very disappointed if I spent that much money. I'm like, well, this is garbage.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, some of those games, I was very disappointed that I spent the time to actually get hold of them for nothing.
Right. Yeah. This wasn't worth my piracy time.
That's right. I've got better things to pirate.
Yeah. Yeah, the ones that I did buy were only the ones that I was 100% positive were going to be great. You know, I bought Archon 2, and I bought Bard's Tale 3, and one or two others. And yeah, because I knew without a shadow of a doubt those were going to be good. But yeah, most of the stuff I pirated was garbage. It wasn't that good.
Yeah, right. It's interesting when you think about the phone ecosystem, you know, now. I mean, like, where people think, oh, $8, that's too much.
Right. Yeah. Well, they give away the games now, and then you get in-app payments. You know, that's the thing, especially for mobile. Well, it's usually free, and then it's not at all free. But
it's the only way to make money. A mobile game that says it's an amazing game. We've spent 10 million hours doing it. It's awesome. I want $8 for it. People go, what? You can't expect $8. It's like, and that's...
Yeah, it's a strange market.
What are you supposed to do?
I think Jordan Mechner created an iOS, you know, like a sequel, basically, to... Karateka, and it released 3D, everything. It cost like what, $4 or something like that,
that's my day job, is free-to-play mobile, and it's a strange business. Like we have a big team pouring hundreds and hundreds of hours into this product, and we continuously update it. We're adding features every week, literally, and we give it away. It's a very strange thing. The company's doing very well. I don't know where the money comes from, but, you know, it's this weird combination of ads and subscription features and other things. It's all very messy, but it's the days of just make a good thing and people will pay you money for it are long gone. Mm. Like, everything is now a subscription and a service and an ad-supported whatever.
Photoshop is a service.
On a tangent, though, the ad-supported games to me is a two-step process because I get the game, then I go and buy the upgrade or whatever so I don't have to put up with the ads.
The plan is working.
But, the subscription model, the pay-to-play, as you said, it's a different world. It's amazing that companies can actually make a profit and have a whole reason for being and to give it away and expect and understand that the money is going to come in. But
it's thin margins. It's back to what you were saying, Michael, where, you know, nowadays the audience is so much bigger so that things can be cheaper. I mean, these free-to-play mobile games, it's like, yes, we're making money off of them, but the minimum audience size for that business model is like 2 million people. Like, it's their margins are razor thin because for every 10,000 people to play, one person will give you a couple of bucks to get rid of the ads or whatever. So, yeah, it's very thin margin business.
Mm. Oh, well, I'll keep doing my bit to keep them going, but I'm finding less and less time for the pay to play games, not because of lack of interest, just a lack of time. I'm going to have to implement that 30-hour day.
All right, I'm looking at the clock
as we roll into 5 o'clock.
It is time maybe to move on to the next stage of our show, but first a word from our sponsor.
The DG Leisure Center arrives at Arding and Hobbs and smashes the price barrier. With the five-function Sinclair Cambridge percentage calculator, now only $7.95, including VAT. The 13-function Cambridge Scientific with logarithmic keys for only $12.95, including VAT. See all the superb Sinclair range at the DG Leisure Center at Arding and Hobbs, Clapham Junction, Southwest 11.
This Christmas, give the Swinger the incredible new Polaroid Land camera for $19.95. Swing it up. It talks to you. Just turn the knob until it says yes right in the viewfinder. Okay, you've got the right setting. 15 seconds later, you zip off a perfect black and white picture. The Swinger freezes action. It's always in focus. It gives you beautiful close-ups. For only $19.95, it's a swinging gift.
Hey, meet the Swinger. Swinger, meet the Swinger, Polaroid Swinger. More than a camera, the dollar's for love, it's only $19.95. Swing it up, it says yes, take the shot, count it down, zip it off. Hey, meet the Swinger, Polaroid Swinger, meet the Swinger.
And we're back. The host's retro computing gift idea this time. I think it was Carrington that found this, and we missed Halloween. So
you gotta warn me before you put a picture like that up.
Yeah. This one took me by surprise.
It is this is the Rasta and Pasta adult floppy disk costume. You know, even though we missed Halloween, we didn't miss it by very long, and it's always Halloween somewhere.
I don't think that's how that works.
Yeah, but anyway, so it's something like a vest that you can wear that looks a bit like a floppy disk. It has some stuff on it. It says 2 HD 10.31 megabytes. I don't know. Is that a real thing?
No.
Okay.
No.
So fortunately they do have nonsensical numbers on it, so you're not confused and try to put it in your drive or anything like that.
Well, it's definitely not working a double density drive. You're just going to lose data the next day.
Yeah. It is a little bit non-square. In certain senses.
It's pretty square, I think. I would say
the aspect ratio
was
off, though.
One of the squarest things I've ever seen.
It's like that floppy coffee table that we looked at a while back.
It's more styled on the 3-inch floppy disk.
This is it's an Amazon listing, and it's listed at basically $39. One rating has given it 5 stars.
Seems legit.
Yeah, I think so.
I think it's too bad that there's a label on it and it says, what does it say, school notes, it's been crossed out, backup files were crossed out in the book report. It should have been just like, here's your dry erase marker and you write your own file system, which would be much more fun, I think.
That would be fun, yeah.
Yeah. Also, I'm holding out for the 5 1/4 inch version.
Right.
The label should have Mom's Recipes crossed out and then Ultima 3 written under it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. Whatever, 1991 taxes.
Yeah.
Crossed out, whatever, Ultima 3, disc 1.
Yeah, exactly.
Or 2, even. That's probably even worse.
I'm surprised it's not listed on Amazon as save button costume.
Yeah. Right. Anyway, yeah, it's pretty excellent. I think this would definitely be something that you could wear any day. It does not have to be Halloween.
At Kansas Fest.
One size fits most. Okay. Anyway, once you are done marveling at that, we can move on to eBay auctions. Blake, I think, has the first of these.
Okay. Yes, I can do that. So I found I've got 2 items I can move through quickly. Okay, so I saw this thing. It's a box with a number of switches on it, flip switches and toggle switches. It caught my eye because it looks old and switchy, and it's labeled Western Dynex Corporation Exerciser DE5020.
Exercising ear, switch flipping. Muscles.
It exercises something, and we'll find out. Yeah, you could definitely exercise your finger with that thing. It has 8 switches across the top. What is it? 10? Anyway, 256, 128, 64. Different sort of bite-sounding lengths, powers of twos. And then there's switches labeled head one, initial / bottom disc recycle. So it's odd, and it's $100, and the there is a little bit of information on it. Western Dynex made a number of hard drives long, long ago, and it turns out, looking a little deeper than the description, is that it is a actual hard disk mechanism exerciser for these Dynex cartridge sort of. But there was a time where hard disks or Winchester disks, I guess, or maybe this is just where they call them, Winchester disks, came in like a stack with a circular, kind of in a circular plastic containment, and you would drop it down into a spindle loader, and then things would start to load. Anyway, this apparently lets you manually control the certain aspects of the disk process, I guess, either for testing purposes or if, I don't know how frequently, you know, if a head got stuck or if there was something going wrong with the data, you could put it through its paces. But that's apparently what this is. They're selling it for $99. Buy it now. There's no bids. But I wondered if I've never seen anything like this. I don't know if this was standard practice to use these things if you ran a data center. Has anyone seen anything like this?
No. This seems like the kind of thing where, like, your need for it is extreme in one way or the other. It's either you have zero need for this or you right. desperately need this.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Right. You're right. You can't get that right. One of your platters is not reading. Oh, no, this is the end of the world. Get the exerciser out and maybe we can recover this. Yeah, but otherwise, why would you? Yeah, it's not. It's strange. I've never heard of this before. I've never read about any sort of manual control of,
Me neither.
Disks for. So I thought it was interesting. It's kind of a cool looking. I mean, it'd be interesting to repurpose it, attach it to a Raspberry Pi, and like control different things with the switches. It looks very future techy from the past. But anyway, so I had that one, and I guess I'll just go and do my second item quickly. This is, and I don't know, again, I'm guessing one of you probably have seen this before, Corporate Systems Center, CSC. It's a book published by those folks called Hard Drive Bible. This is edition 7. This one was produced in 1996, I think. There are obviously earlier editions that were produced earlier. And what it is, there's not a lot of information in the eBay auction. It's selling for $25, buy it now. As you might imagine, it is a book that details the ins and outs of a great many different types of drives, like interfaces, different geometries. I found the Internet Archive has some or several versions of this, the 8th edition here, archived and scanned, but it's just interesting flipping through it. There's sections where they're talking about, different physical connectors with photographs. They talk about SCSI protocols, different levels. There are different track densities. And then they go through a great, like, hundreds of pages of actual, model numbers of drives from different, drive manufacturers. And the same thing for controllers. So it seems like, it could be quite useful today if you are maintaining and acquiring and setting up new retro, systems with parts from here, here and there. You buy a drive, will it work with this system, with this controller? This would seem to have the answer. So I'd never run across this before, and there's definitely times in the past where it would have made things easier, kind of going down a Google rabbit hole of determining whether this drive I got from eBay is going to work on this, this Amiga or this next machine. And I see, actually, I'm flipping through it now on the Internet Archive. I see they have a section on floppy drives and the different manufacturers and the drive types. So it seems like it would have been rather useful back then, probably, to a service center, then, rather useful now if you're, trying to piece things together, as a collector. So, has anyone seen this book in any form?
Yeah, I'd seen it at the Internet Archive before, but I found it for a different reason, because it's CSC, and it's not the CSC that I used to work for. So this is a corporate systems center, and I used to work for Computer Sciences Corporation, but interesting things there. But as you said, it would have been a great service center resource back in the day, and potentially useful today for various drive enthusiasts, mm-hmm. and absolutely useless any time period in between the two.
Yeah. Right. One thing that I actually do kind of like about this thing, I'll put it back up just so I can sort of point it out, is that it's
done Bible style. That's what I love about
it. It's like even apart from the information content, they went all in on this like Bible metaphor, so it's got the little like cloth bookmark hanging out of it, and I can't quite tell if it's got like gold on the side, but it at least it sort of looks as if it it's sort of embossed gold on the cover.
Gold on the page.
So, as a physical object,
gold on the
cool.
page edges would just be the clincher for me. I was tempted when I saw this come up. I was tempted, but to get the thing. But $72 priority international mail. I was still tempted, but I'd have to do it the long way via my transshipper. I'd have to find out if it has gold leaf edging.
We've talked a bit in the past in the context of like my Amiga troubles and so on, where information like this is difficult to get now. Like if you were wanting to build, say, a 486 DOS PC for gaming, you wanted to play old, the golden era of VGA games, for example, it might be pretty hard to figure out like which hard drive can I use with this IDE card that I bought on eBay.
Right.
And if you just try to Google that, like you're never going to find the information you need. So you actually have to go to a contemporary book from the time like this to get that information. So it's great that it's on Internet Archive, so people can look on there.
Yes, I think now that I'm aware of it, I'm sure at some point I'll go to the Internet Archive. Although, as Paul points out, it is quite a physical item. And I'll point out, Michael, I spent my first post as a web developer at the same CSC that you worked for in the past, long, long past. So, Lotus Notes Domino developer.
Yeah, well, they're still CSC stateside. They're now DTX outside of the US.
Okay, I did not know that.
So you increment the first two letters by one and then just go nuts on the last one.
And that's it for my offerings there.
Excellent. Carrington, you have a Commodore.
I have a Commodore, mostly because I picked this auction like 2 weeks ago, and it ends up being very prescient, I guess, because the point was to say I was looking for something locally. Weirdly, I needed a VHS player because there's a movie I want to watch that only exists on VHS. And I thought, you know what? I'll grab a VCR. How hard can it be to find a VCR? So I searched for VCRs for sale in Toronto, found this site called Max Sold, which turns out it's like an auction thing. It's all over the place, but it focuses on downsizing and estate sales. So it's another auction site, but it's half of the auctions on here are just people like have a house or they've inherited a ton of stuff. They give it to Max Sold. It puts everything on and say, here you go. Everything begins at $1 and just things sell for it. They sell and you just can find things. And surprisingly found a ton of computers and monitors and vintage stuff, all of which mostly goes very cheaply because it's all untested and there's no shipping available. So this is strictly funding local auctions. So this was just, I picked one as an example. This is listed as a Jazz Drive. It is not a Jazz Drive. It's a Commodore 64. It's going for $55, which is surprisingly high, it seems, for this site. It's a 64 and a keyboard, and it's available near me. Where is it? In Maple, which is 10 minutes north of me. But it'll say, like, bring your own packing material. It's located in the basement. That's how these auction sites go. So it's just another thing. I kind of wasn't aware of this as a site, so I picked this as an example of here's a local computer. Another thing that caught my eye was this camera, which is an Oshawa. It's the Big Swinger. I mean, like, don't you want a camera called the Big Swinger? So it turns out the Polaroid created a camera called the Big Swinger, and I don't know why it's called the Big Swinger, but I love everything about the fact that it is. So you can learn these things.
Oh, it's a large or a medium format Polaroid?
Yeah, it's one of those big where you pull it at the back and you wait.
Yeah, like a 5x7. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So big old Polaroid, Big Swinger inbox that you can pick up for $1 because you'd be the first person to bid on it. Every auction begins at $1 and it just increments by $1 and sells for what they want to sell for. In the last couple of weeks, I saw Apple IIs on there, a lot of Commodore stuff, Atari things, a lot of old electronics, a lot of things sold with no cables. It seems what this company will do, go into a house, gather up all the extension cords, all the cables, and put them in one big lot and say, here are all the power things in this building for some reason. And then here's the computer with no cables. Here's the Wii with no cables. Here's the Commodore 64 with no cables. Why did you do that? And I guess they don't want to have the wrong thing. I don't know. It's weird. But if you want to find things where it's big and heavy, like if you're getting a giant monitor, it can be expensive to find on eBay because of the shipping and you're worried it's not going to arrive. This can be another source for things. But this is also the kind of site that will probably end up with all of your stuff when you pass away if you don't make other arrangements. A company like Maxwell will come in, take a bunch of photos of everything you have, stick it all online and say, you got 6 days, starts at $1, it goes for what it goes for. Come and pick it up on Sunday.
So this is the pile with all the computers, this is all the cables, and this is all the stickers that we took off stuff. I don't know what they were for.
Exactly. So anyway, if you're in or near Toronto, you can pick yourself up a Commodore 64 with disk drive for $55.
But did you get the VHS player?
I got my VHS player for $1. It's this gorgeous 1970s wood panel thing. Works beautifully. I love it. And it was $1. I had to go pick it up, but that's what it was. I was the only bidder. I put in a bid of like $5, and I was the only person. So it's just that I hadn't been aware of this site. I think there's a lot like it that do estate sales. But half the sales on this are estate things, and half the sales are just called downsizing, which is you yourself are trying to get rid of a whole bunch of your stuff. You just put up a bunch of things. And then the pickup slots will be very specific. It'll say, like, for this auction, if you're the winning person, pickups will be this Sunday between 2 and 6. And as soon as you win, you can pick the five-minute slot you want. That's when you're picking up. Like, it's very specific. And they want you in and out quick. Pick up your stuff and go. So, but you might be able to find heavy local things, maybe a lot less expensive than on eBay plus shipping.
Yeah.
Because how many people near you are looking for monitors? Like in my case, in Oshawa and Maple and stuff. So.
No, that's a good thing because you know so many people order a large CRT and they get delivered a 3D jigsaw.
Sounds like a box of Smarties when it arrives. Yeah. So that's it.
Yeah, I have
Commodore 64. My God, I feel dirty. That's
what I know you're a Commodore curious too.
There's a Commodore SX64, the executive SX64,
which
just sold, and that went for a lot. It was like $450. I don't know if that's a good price or not, but that's what that sold for here in Toronto on this same site.
Yeah, those are they're a little bit rare. Except that I can point to one right behind me.
Which pile is that?
It's the one under, actually, you can sort of see the Apple III. It's underneath the Apple III.
That's it. Mostly you should buy the Big Swinger, though. $1.
Yeah. I forget what it's called, what the site is, but it's, you know, it sort of searches estate sales, and I will often kind of point to Maxold. And, you know, that is pretty useful for stuff that's local, but there's got to be somebody who's selling something interesting.
Right.
But it searches for the keyword computer, you know, just because nobody knows what to label these things. And so usually I get like, you know, modern computer desks or whatever, you know, but last time I've actually gone to something like that, it was sort of in the before times. And so they just sort of like let you into the house and, you know, sort of walk around in the basement, and they've put, you know, Ultima 2 in with the board games. But actually, it was pretty interesting. The one time that I can think of recently-ish that I went to one of these things, it was fortune hunters kind of. It was people running around like checking, you know, on their phone to see like what could this sell for, you know, as they were trying to run around and grab stuff. And I'm like, I know what some of these things are, and you know, I know that it would be interesting to have this Adventure International catalog from 1982 or whatever, you know, but I have to wait for the guy to check on his phone to see if like maybe he can flip it for something. So
search terms are key on that, clearly, because I was just searching my area and I searched like Commodore, Amiga, nothing, and then I searched for computer and I found a ZX81, but it's listed as a Sinclair calculator. But you can see in the picture that it's clearly a ZX81, so it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Michael, you are next in the order.
Okay. Well, I actually bought this one new back in the day, and I was just coming across some other Nat Geo things, and it's a wonderful collection of, up to when it was released on CD, a archive collection of all the National Geographic magazines on CD. So from the original first issue to where they developed the iconic yellow frame on the cover. And it's in a wonderful little presentation box. I believe that most of this stuff is online these days, but if you're after something that looks almost as good as that hard drive Bible, this is the collection for you. Comes with a viewer and whatnot, but I believe they're all just PDFs that are on the disc, so you shouldn't have any trouble running them on a modern machine or a retro machine. And $28, that's considerably less than what I paid for it new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does look pretty nice.
Yeah, it was great. I sat down for ages just grabbing a box of the out of it, selecting a CD, and then just randomly picking an issue. I used to purchase the National Geographic hard copy, but had no desire to go back for the collection from 1888 to 1990 at that stage. I just thought that this was a great way of getting the older issues.
Yeah. It's interesting. I appreciate it, and at the same time, I'm struggling to imagine myself actually taking out a physical disc and putting it in to read a PDF.
Those days are well and truly gone. If I wanted to go back and look at these, the first thing I'd do is I would effectively spin through all the discs and load all the individual files up so that I could then just browse them online on a tablet or a computer.
But it does, it actually does kind of look like a moderately nice display. I mean, like, you know, even if you've just ripped all the CDs to your hard drive, I mean, you know, it looks nice.
It's a handsome box.
Yep. That's it from me. Just something different.
All right. So here's one thing that I found. It is a Commodore 64 multicolor replacement, it seems. So if you have a Commodore 64 and you think that what you need are orange, green, and yellow keys,
then you're wrong.
And I think blue is an option, but only for the spacebar. Then this is something you can get. Buy it now of $149. I think this might be just a one particular configuration, but it points to a site that has more of these. So if you want to see more of these kinds of
modified keyboards, why is there a blood splattered
keyboards? Yeah, I don't know. You can get a Commodore 64 with what appears to be gray and red and blood splattered keys, or a sort of rainbow one with red orange. And so what's interesting about this is I think these are actually real keys with the lettering preserved and then somehow colored. They're like maybe they're bleached and then dyed or something like that. But at least the way it's described in the auction, the keys are colored using a special mixture of paint and clear coat. Let's see, keyboard is like new. The keys are colored while preserving the original font. And I think it's the preserving that made me
how
believe
they're
that
doing
it was
that.
Actually. Yeah.
But the printer, though, like the keys aren't the same as the factory ones were, right? Like the Petsky characters are on the front surface of the keys on the original, but here they're on the tops of the keys. So if you...
I think they have been in both places at different years.
Oh, okay.
I believe.
Okay.
I think that's the case. I'm not positive, but I think so.
Okay. Yeah, I'm only Commodore curious, so I wouldn't know.
Yeah. Anyway, I thought this was a weird
are
thing
the cases
to exist.
Part of this? Paul, are there cases part of this? I guess they are. Right?
I think they are. I think so. This is a single auction that points to a larger enterprise, and I think the larger enterprise sells
includes
more things. Though, actually, at $149, I mean, you have to be pretty invested in this, and in a way that's I don't know. Like, I don't know what exactly your focus would be that you would feel that you need to have a Commodore 64 at this color. But anyway.
If they had, I mean, it would be interesting. I mean, as far as the larger enterprise, and it might be worth looking at. I mean, I have one Commodore 64C, and it didn't change my opinion that I've held for all my life that the C64 has the most uncomfortable keyboard I've ever used. That's not Chiclet. So I wonder if they also offer keycap, you know, units that have had their actual mechanisms, not caps, mechanisms replaced,
right.
Like with Cherry, Mechanical, something like that. I don't know. That's a bigger question. We don't need to get into that. But that would be something I could see spending that kind of money on, or maybe even a bit more,
Yeah.
Yeah, I second that. The Commodore 64 keyboard is awful. It's just terrible.
Yeah, it's so soft. It's like it's mushy. Yeah, I'm a keyboard nut. I spend hundreds of dollars on mechanical keyboards, and I have way more than I need.
The curvature on the keys on the Commodore keyboard is too severe. Like, they're very, very heavily cupped, and so when your fingers are sitting on them, it feels weird. You can't slide your fingers around, and it's just...
To me, it always felt like a typewriter from, like, the 60s, like the cup, the curvature. I don't know. It never appealed to me. I know we're gonna get a lot of feedback from that, but sorry.
No, they won't be able to write us because they're trying to type on that keyboard and it just doesn't work. So we're safe.
Yeah.
Here's a quick thing that seemed pertinent. This is a Nolo Legisoft Willmaker for the Apple II Plus, 2E, 2C, and 2GS. So if you needed a way to get started and you actually wanted to use your retro computers to do it.
I guess that would be the most appropriate way, I suppose. If you're if you're going to do it for the retro computers, then do it on the retro computer.
Just make sure to put a sticker on that computer because they're going to need it to read your will if you make it with this thing.
Yes.
Yes. And here is an actual Sinclair calculator.
Oh, look at that!
Oh,
it's a. I thought that was kind of cool.
Oh, it's a kit. Oh, that's cool.
It's a kit, yeah. It's an unbuilt 1970s self-assembly kit.
That's
so
neat.
I can see how they could be easily confused.
That's cool. I've never seen that before. That's
yeah, I didn't know Sinclair made kits. That's really cool.
And that is an original? I mean, that's from long ago?
You could actually get your ZX80 or ZX81 as a kit.
Yeah, still shrink wrapped even. Yeah,
I remember that.
Yeah, this predates it. It's got almost a week to go. It's already at 45 pounds.
Yeah, I feel like that's going to go for a lot being unopened.
Yeah.
Right. And being so close to Sir Clive Sinclair's passing. So.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I would like that. I would definitely like that.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, I will leave it at that because there are so many of us. And so then I guess that is the end of the eBay items. Any closing thoughts? We can go around. Blake is the first in the alphabet.
Okay. Nothing to note in particular. I probably, like as we talked about earlier, and that was our main discussion. I plan to give some personal thought to, and you know, hopefully take soon better action upon some sort of estate planning as far as my little collection, and hopefully I'll actually do that. We'll see. But that's about all I got.
All right. Carrington.
I talked about getting a VCR, so that's kind of retro. I have a couch, so that's new.
That's also kind of retro.
My life is in turmoil. So much stuff.
New turntable on the way.
I'm going to have to get rid of this desk to make up for that.
Yeah, you own like four things now. How are you managing?
It's a burden. It really is hard. I wake up in cold sweats. Too many things. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. Get my stickers ready.
Is that
ready.
Because you're sleeping on the floor?
I bet it's a lot more comfortable than that stupid couch. It's a couch from Article. It's like a...
Okay.
Somebody had a spare couch. So I said, okay, I'll take it. To tide me over until I get my sofa's finally going to arrive, hopefully in 3 months. It's terrible. It's a terrible couch. Awful.
It's good that you have a bed.
Yeah. Yes. I'm glad you're whispering, though, so it can't hear you.
So Article can't... The Article people are in on it. This podcast was not sponsored by Article.com.
I was going to say, we're obliged to mention Article in a podcast, so I'm glad that we got to do it somehow.
All right. Michael?
No, nothing really going on apart from just my continuous scanning of things that I find interesting and that other people probably don't.
Yeah, cool. I've been doing a fair amount of scanning and processing, and I don't know if I said this in a part that made it into what will be on the feed, but I appreciate your recommendation, Michael, of Scantailer Advanced.
Yep.
That is I originally thought it was not going to work very well, and it turns out I like it a lot.
Yeah.
It's actually really super useful. So I've been digging through a bunch of my scanning, and it does a lot of the processing.
I find it great for books with my hit and miss scanning method. As long as the text is on the screen and you scan it, you can get it into the archive copy that you do. It's great.
Yeah, it does a lot of it'll sense page splits.
Yep.
I've done a lot of scanning of disks because I've been doing a lot of floppy disk imaging, and if I put two disks up on the plate and scan them, so I can get through them twice as fast, it will treat them as if they are two pages. I can just let it auto split.
Yeah, it is very handy that way. For that. So I'm glad one useful piece of device I've given in this last 10 years. Thanks.
Yes, excellent. But yeah, that's what I've been doing is a lot of scanning in preparation for trying to do the processing that will let me have less of this stuff. So we'll see how that goes. Quinn?
Yeah, I guess I have somewhat retro news, I guess. So moment of silence. My 40-year-old Radio Shack Micronta multimeter died this week, and I'm very sad about it, actually.
Cool.
I'm actually legitimately kind of sad about it. We're not even joking, because I bought it new in 1981. I would have been six and with my allowance, and it has worked flawlessly ever since. Radio Shack used to make good stuff, it turns out. And I've, carefully packed it and moved it from apartment to house to apartment to apartment over the course of 40 years. And original leads, original everything. And it finally died. The batteries had been leaking in it periodically, and I'd managed to keep catching it and replacing them. And a couple of times I had to go and stick the terminals in vinegar to get the corrosion off and stuff. But Yeah, I guess that happened one too many times, and it wouldn't start up even with fresh batteries. And I opened it up, and the mechanical dial switches, it's like a multi-layered switching mechanism, and the whole thing was just a ball of rust. And I'm not sure how and when that happened exactly, but so the electronics are fine, but the elaborate mechanical switching mechanism inside it was just totally corroded. So, and you know, it is probably fixable if one wanted to get heroic about it, but you know, it was time. It had a good run, so yeah, I bought a new one. But it's one of those things where sometimes you tweet something and you realize how many followers you actually have. It was one of those. I got this huge response when I tweeted about this. Like Dave Jones from EEV blog replied, and like it was crazy. So people were sending me all funny images of funeral pyres. Thank you, Michael, and various other things.
Well, it was a valiant warrior. It deserves a warrior's funeral.
Send it off to sea.
Absolutely, yeah. So yeah, it was kind of turned into kind of a fun Twitter thread. A bunch of people, other people, turns out have that same meter from that same era, and so people were sharing photos of their 80s Micronta multimeters. It's shocking how well made those things were.
Oh yeah, I agree with you. I love the older style ones. The digital ones these days, they've got no soul. They have no essence.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and a big reason I hung on to it for so long is because I hate auto-ranging meters. And for a long time there, all multimeters were auto-ranging. And so you stick the probes on there and you're like, oh, it's got 5 volts. No, it's got 5 millivolts, which means zero. And you have to constantly be doing that little mental calculation every time you look at the display. They've since fixed that, so I bought a new Fluke, and it has a manual ranging on it as well as an option. So at least they finally fixed that, so I feel a little better about replacing it. But yeah, it was a noble thing, and one of the few remaining pieces of equipment I have from that era, from the, you know, retro computing era. I still have my Apple II Plus, and I had that multimeter, and now I just have my Apple II Plus.
Well,
so that's it.
All right, I think we made it to the end. Not quite 2.5 hours, so that's good. So that I will say that is it for the show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show on the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. Answer the questions so that we know that you are not a robot. Carrington is presently imitating a robot in his little window. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. Please write a review on iTunes. That will help other people find the show. And until next time,
Retro Compute!
Which may be Jack's new band.
I hope so.
It's
all ukuleles.
Ukulele death metal.